Michael Beeshall, thank you very much for joining us here. You're a well-known author. You've got a trilogy at the moment, obviously Unbound Justice, and the other two are?
Yes, Unshackled and Succession.
Right. And I'm reading Unbound Justice, the first in the three, and it's a good read, so well recommended. We'll talk more about those at the end of the interview. But we're here primarily today to talk about the architectural styles that have shaped Sydney. And I guess the first one that comes to mind, correct me if I'm wrong, is under Governor Lachlan Macquarie back in the 19th century. How did that come about?
Yes, well, that's true, Greg. Up to that point, after the First Fleet and up to the when Macquarie came in about 1810, it was a colony basically constructed for survival, for habitation survival. That was purely the key and the need for the colony. We have to remember that New South Wales was a convict destination. America had its War of Independence. England needed another place to dump its convicts. So there was no plans from England to establish a country, let alone a new colony. So it was purely a colony. So there was tents, canvas, wattle and daub huts, very perfunctory and so forth. Macquarie came in 1810. I guess he stimulated, by his vision and ambition, he stimulated a lot of building works that were very much necessary. Courthouse was needed, a hospital was needed, a church was needed. Mm-hmm. They're the more sort of, I guess, community or governmental type buildings, but they do, by their nature, by their representation, define the authority of Macquarie. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, people recognised and respected that there was something that was actually happening, and governor was taking control.
Yeah.
So there was some architect. There was a chap called Watt who was an article clerk and who was one of Macquarie's aide-de-camp.
Mm-hmm.
And he was he helped Macquarie in his ideas for planning. Macquarie's wife also had some ideas of design. So it was a very good period that I think really sort of started Australia's built environment in a very physical way.
Indeed, and I guess a visionary of sorts too, because primarily before that, I guess, as you described so well, it was a mishmash in many ways, and it was not a particularly good look with the tents and everything else, but the styles that evolved, Sydney nowadays is a mixture of styles, old and new, and we talk about the convict situation too, of course. Another person that I guess helped Lachlan Macquarie was Greenway, was the convict.
Yes, he did, and he came out that actually he was sent to Australia, transported for a forgery that he committed, and he was given the task by Macquarie as a pro tem architect. He was the government architect, but not fully, because that needed England's approval. But he did assist Macquarie. An interesting, very interesting character. Mm-hmm. I guess there were hardly any persons in the colony that he got on with.
Who Greenway?
Greenway, yes.
Oh.
He went out his way to make enemies of just about everybody, including Macquarie. When Macquarie sort of handed him his orders at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
he responded with a note saying, "Well, it's not really good enough."
Yeah.
So I mean, you think that's stupid now? You think think of an architect getting a gig like that, and sort of saying, "Well, hey, I've got a great opportunity. I've got a great palette now to really perform." He went out of his way, and of course, human relationships and how we deal with people is very important. So, but I guess his architectural style and his expertise and talent were there. They were certainly there. He was a trained architect. He was a painter and an artist, and
mm-hmm.
There are examples of his works, and they're quite brilliant. But he was involved in quite a few of the buildings in that sort of 1810 to 1820 period, and including the convict barracks in Macquarie Street, St James Church in as we know, on the top of King Street, and that was a wonderful building.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And the Hyde Park Barracks?
Hyde Park Barracks was probably one of Greenway's best. It was a three-storey, it had the classical lines of the pediment and the entablature, and had the pilasters. It still has an elegance today, and yet there were plans to demolish it in the 1950s, but thank God we saved that.
Yeah.
And St. James Church, and additionally, I think one of those things to remember, St. James Church, it was actually added onto by John Verge in increments. So Verge, in his additions of, I guess, external, I think it was external walkways to mm-hmm. St. James Church, had a sympathy to the original architect. So it was good that way.
Yeah, a lot of things happened then. I guess also with Francis Greenway, would you call him a tortured genius or just someone very difficult to get along with?
Yes, I think either one of those terms, Greg, I think is apt, because I think he could have made himself a lot easier had he a little ability to get on with people. But look, thank God that Macquarie persevered with him, and Greenway actually did some fine buildings. Even the lighthouse in South Head was stood for many years. Was one of Greenway's buildings.
Oh right, was it? Okay.
Yes, and he designed that and he built that, and of course he gave it. Said it would be built in 4 months, and it took 2 years to build. You know, things haven't changed from 2010.
Yeah, set the bar low, and away you go.
That's right.
But with Greenway, Michael, do you think you would look at one of Greenway's buildings and say, "Well, that's a Greenway," or did he merge different styles and into what?
That's a good point you asked that, because there's an idea that we say, well, what is, and you did raise it before, I think, that what does typify, you know, Australian architecture in terms of that period?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there are examples of the classic architecture. The classic form of architecture, as we know, the Ionic and Doric columns and the pediment entablature, all we see with the, you know, the Parthenon and so forth, they were reserved for government type buildings, and the Neo-Gothic was reserved for other institutional buildings or churches.
Yeah.
So Greenway was pretty true to the form of the classic architects, and his style and his composition and scale were all sort of out of the rule book and out of the so the things like the St. James Church, like the convict barracks and the churches at Windsor and mm-hmm. Liverpool, which he designed,
mm-hmm.
Which are still there. They all have the right. They're all informed by good architectural practice.
The church at Windsor is beautiful. I think I know the one you mean. Did Greenway design that?
Yes, he did. I think there was some Luke's Liverpool and also there was the church at Windsor, because Macquarie, one of the five towns of Windsor, as being the sort of the town plan town planning of its time.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's beautiful.
He said we need to sort of really get Windsor sort of sorted out, and he did that, and I think that's something which I think we need to be very thankful to Macquarie about. So it's Greenway did build in Windsor.
That's incredible. And you talked about the Neo-Gothic, of course. With John Verge, we're speaking about the Elizabeth Bay House, the St Andrew's Cathedral. Examples of that.
Yes, well, that's correct, and they are still existing. St Mary's Cathedral, that burnt down, so it was rebuilt in the 1860s.
Mm.
So they're all very much representative. We're all sort of comfortable about knowing those sort of designs.
Mm. And we spoke before about Australianisms in design, and I guess we mentioned the veranda. How did that come about?
Well, that was a bit of a fluke. Anecdotally, there was, I believe, only three verandas in Sydney in the early 1800s up to 1810, and
mm.
one of those was on the Government House, which is at the corner of Phillip Street.
Mm-hmm.
That was a prefabricated tent, timber and canvas tent, that Phillip, out of his own funds, brought out with the First Fleet, and it was the home of governors until 1842. That was sort of one idea that there was hardly any opportunity to sort of build in that period.
But of course, I guess with the veranda being very sensible and very practical, and being recognised now as an Australian thing, but it came from India.
Well, yes, that's right. The The veranda wasn't recognised as a shade device. It was more recognised as a connection between buildings. In other words, you got out of your carriage or your gig and you got under the veranda to keep out of the rain rather than kept the sun off.
Mm.
And the houses of early Sydney, especially in the primitive period, were really shadeless boxes. So the idea from the veranda came from India. It was actually used as an architectural element on the Rum Hospital in Macquarie Street that we know about, and it had a lot of controversy at the time because people said, "Why are you putting this sort of architectural element on? What is it?" But then the country houses, because they were just galvanised iron and virtually heat boxes, there was no respect for the environment and how to adapt to it.
Mm.
Some smart farmers at some time obviously said, "Well, let's extend the roof line of the corrugated sheeting to the outside and form a shading device for the external walls." They wanted to keep the heat off the external walls of the house.
Mm.
And by doing that, if you keep the heat off, you cool the house to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And so that sort of came back from the country into the city rather than a migration from the city to the country, that idea.
Yeah, I think with those particular designs, what as Sydney was being shaped by these new designs and things like we've just mentioned, do you think the people were realising what was evolving? Because we look at it now and it's an integral part of not only Sydney's history, but it's still its general feel. You can walk around and still view some of these magnificent buildings, giving an ambience, if you like.
Yes, and fortunately, within that government area of Macquarie Street, you have the sort of the context of buildings of... You have St James Church, then you come around the corner of the Convict Barracks and you've got the Rum Hospital. Mm. And then you've got, further down Macquarie Street, you've got Government House, which was later, of course, and the Stables, which were the Conservatorium of Music.
Mm.
And that was a controversial project of its time because Macquarie wanted stables for his horses and his stable hands and so forth. And it took years to build, and it started just when Commissioner Big came out, who had a role to investigate Macquarie. Everyone panned it and pillaged it for years. So.
Yeah, there was, I think, was it the Victorian buildings that were created by sandstone? Because I was just thinking of the rocks and the sandstone from the rocks. What was that, where they got the sandstone from, or what?
Yes, well, that's a good point, because the whole basis of the trilogy, the Sandstone Trilogy, is to literally say that Sydney is built on Hawkesbury sandstone. It's the geological rock of the whole colony.
Brilliant, yeah.
And of course, it was garnered from the coves and inlets around Sydney, as we all know, just for building rocks. However, the quality of that sandstone was very poor. It sheared very easily. It was friable.
Mm.
So Macquarie, again, look, we always come back to Macquarie. He said in 1810, no, we want a formal quarry. So round about Fort Phillip, which is now the Argyle Cut, he set up a proper quarry, but it was a very slow process. You had to drill by hand, which was required a jumper, a steel jumper and a sledgehammer and two guys, and you had to blast it with gunpowder and saltpeter, and then you had to hand polish it by hand.
Jeez.
You know, so it was extremely expensive, but yes, a lot of those stones did come, especially the stones for the lighthouse and the government buildings came from the Argyle Cut.
Incredible stuff. And the architects of that period, I guess, Michael, we mentioned Francis Greenway and the fact that he was... at times difficult to get along with, and it's a wonder that things were achieved at all, but they were. Then we mentioned, I think, John Verge.
Yes.
And you were speaking before about Edmund Blackett, was it?
Yes, Edmund Blackett. Now, he came out later. He was sort of later than Greenway.
Mm-hmm.
But again, he was very instrumental in the buildings of the Sydney University buildings, the Great Hall, and other buildings around the place. So he was another. That was a sort of a later period, which was well after Macquarie, of course.
Mm, we can discuss that at a later stage. That's very interesting in itself, too, I guess. But we spoke about the sandstone. We spoke about the rocks, and of course, there was a period in the 60s, I think, or the 70s, where the rocks was under threat from developers, and I guess that would have ripped the guts or the soul out of the city in many ways.
Yes, well, we would have lost probably the last bit of built architecture that represented those times.
Mm.
And it was more, not so much the built architecture, it was actually the context of the area. The rocks started as a series of caves and cliff ledges, very much like the harbour itself now. And and it was very much maritime. Was a lot of ships just docked there. So it was the first port of call the sailors jumped off at and the last port when they jumped back on ship.
Yeah.
So it was very much a maritime with all... With all the attendant, I suppose we call it maritime infrastructure these days, but I guess it's a nice word to say for what actually existed there with the inns and all the other places of pretty dubious repute. But we lost that scale, that one or two story scale. It would have been replaced with a whole series of high rise and would have just ruined everything.
Well, a place of some action and some interest to a lot of people, obviously, over the years. The Rocks, incredible. I think I was mentioning before when we were talking about... The ambience of the area for me is somewhere where I always go when I'm in Sydney because of that, the creation of mood through buildings, which you know very well about because of your expertise. How has that shaped Sydney into what it is today?
Well, the interesting thing about it is that whole Macquarie Street area, and I guess to more extent the Rocks area, do still have that ambience. To get it more, I guess, a colonial feel, you would need to sort of go to the places like Windsor and maybe parts of Liverpool to get the feeling of the period. But it's Sydney is starting to, I guess, still recognise that there are pockets of architectural built environment that should be maintained and actually, you know, looked after, and I think that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think parts of Potts Point, Maclay Street, that was a very powerful sort of area in terms of houses for the rich. But we have to remember that by 1810, the extent of Sydney went from basically Rushcutters Bay to Glebe out to a toll booth on Parramatta Road. Would you believe just about where Broadway is and Central Station, they had a toll booth to charge people on their way to Parramatta.
Wow. So,
Parramatta was a thriving city because Parramatta was essentially set up for an agricultural period because the first governors recognised that, they nearly starved. Within the Third Fleet, actually, the Second Fleet supplied them, but the colony nearly starved and they needed agricultural land, and the best land was sort of Parramatta and West. So they needed to set up there, hence the reason Parramatta was set up as a place.
Oh, I see. So actually you didn't have to go far in those days to be considered out in the bush.
No, you did not. So the likes of even in Unbound Justice, and one of the main characters, he buys a house all the way out of Point Piper in Wolseley Road, and that was considered the bush at the time.
Piper?
Yes, in Point Piper.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's
interesting. So it was an area that developed, and of course, you know, now obviously, it's a wealthiest street in Australia. So.
Yeah, was there a period of stalling during that first initial period with Macquarie and Greenway, or did things start rocking and rolling from the very beginning?
No, it really didn't. It took Macquarie's stimulant to actually get things going. He opened purse strings. He paid architects out of what they call the police fund, which really has, which was money set up to obviously pay some police constables at the time. Macquarie said, no, we'll use that for public work. So he did everything that I guess a Royal Commission now would frown on.
Wow.
But he really started the whole scheme. But you know, juxtaposed to that, you had the very, very wealthy individual, Simeon Lord, you had John MacArthur's, obviously, you had the Wentworths, you had the Reebys, the Rileys, the Cables. All these people were making money out of the growth of the colony in terms of, you know, imports. And there's one little story of the New South Wales Corps, and they literally ran Sydney in terms of, in the early part, this is before Macquarie, and I do digress, but it's an important point to note that the New South Wales Corps during sort of, I guess, through Hunter and King, those governors, would go out on ships, the Corps would go out on ships, coming in, bringing imports in from England, would buy the imports and sell them to Sydney on an average of between 100 and 1,000% profit.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, the governor had little chance to control these people. So there was this whole, if you like, this whole underground or sort of growth of very wealthy men and the houses they wanted to build and so forth, as against what was happening with the hierarchy through England.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Michael, because the next question for me then would be, did Macquarie's arrival, I think, in 1810? And
yes, 1810, yeah. Yes.
Did that promote some stability? Was there...
It did, Greg, because what he did was he sent the New South Wales Corps home.
Ah.
And he brought his own 73rd Regiment out with him.
Okay.
So he was a major general in his own right. So he bought his own 73rd Regiment, and if you like to know, as we all do, we like to have people around us to work with that we can trust.
Yep.
And he bought his 73rd Regiment. So a lot of that was nipped in the bud. But the MacArthurs and the Wentworths and others still were, politically, they were still white-handing Macquarie even through this whole 10-year period.
So, yeah, I suppose he couldn't do everything, but I guess getting rid of the Rum Corps was a giant step forward.
A big step, because literally of the Rum Hospital, as we know, it was Australia's first public-private partnership. I think it was Blaxell, Riley and Darcy Wentworth, they would finance and build the Rum Hospital.
Yeah.
If they were allowed to import 45,000 gallons of rum.
Oh.
Right?
Oh.
Now, they'd pay duty on that, naturally, but, I mean, you can imagine the war. And, of course, the budget blew out, and poor old Macquarie's arm was squeezed, and he had to fork out another 15,000 gallons of rum.
Yeah, I tell you what, that's a lot of rum, my friend. That's a lot of rum.
It is a lot of rum. But the interesting thing was, it didn't cost the government a cracker. So this is the sort of innovation, in a way, that Macquarie sort of went around the rules to a fairly legal way to sort of get what he wanted.
Very innovative and very visionary in that sense. Now, Francis Greenway, of course, was working with him, and we spoke about Greenway, but Macquarie left in, what, 1820?
Yes, that's correct.
And Greenway kept working?
Well, he did, but he eventually... He did some work, but he, because of his nature and his personality, he got everybody offside. No one really wanted to work with him. But he did some further designs throughout that period, and he retired in penury up on the up near the Hawkesbury on about 200 acres of land. Died of, and there's not an epitaph or not a monument to him in Sydney.
Is that right?
Mm.
Wow, because I was just about to ask you, Michael, if you could name maybe five of the most prestigious or distinctive buildings that Greenway was responsible for.
Yeah, well, you can. I mean, obviously, you've got St James and you've got the barracks, and you've got, you've got the Windsor churches, and you've got some Luke's Liverpool, and I think there's a couple of others that have noted. Might just give some mind at the moment, but they are there. But you know, it's the old impression that someone does so well, and yet because he got offside and he just sort of drifted off. His son became a builder, and it's a fascinating biography by Alastair McGregor just on his life, and it's well worth reading. It's a great book.
You've got me interested. I might pick that up. That sounds very interesting. Now, I guess, and the mere fact that he died in the situation and with very little recognition, perhaps it was more to do with his failure to get on side with people more than his ability with architecture.
Look, I suspect that's the case, and it's like, it doesn't matter what you do in life and what profession, what road you tread, you do have to still get on with your fellow man or woman and do things.
We'll be speaking next about the gold rush, the impact of the gold rush on architecture in Australia and how that came about.
Look, yes, I think that's a very good point, because during the colonial period we did have some growth between sort of the 1820s to the 1840s and so forth. But I think the gold rush was, I like to think, the internet of its time. It had such a monumental impact on both population and building typology in New South Wales and Victoria. It was extraordinary.
It's an incredible subject, Michael. The whole thing about a creation from the mind, you think of something and then you plan, you do. I guess whether it's a creation of a piece of music or a writing, a piece of literature or a building itself, it stems from the human mind, the human condition, and we can see that reflected in all these wonderful buildings.
Yes, and thank God that we still have evidence of them. We don't have to rely on the internet or Google or look up some pictures in a book. We still have physical evidence of their existence.
What could be more beautiful than walking around, and we're talking about Sydney, than viewing some of these lovely buildings, and for a moment perhaps back in history?
Yes, and just pausing and just trying to understand but some of them, both of those buildings that Greenway built were icons of their time. They were so huge for Sydney. You
incredible.
Can imagine coming from this huge lift up from the primitive period of tents and wattled and daub and so forth to these great buildings.
Totally incredible. And Michael, thank you so much for sharing that with us today. And people can listen to this, obviously, as an audio download too, and podcast. But we'll continue to talk about architecture during the period and a bit later with our next conversation. But Your books, the trilogy, magnificent stuff, the Sandstone trilogy. If you could perhaps just one more time name those three books and where people may be able to pick them up from.
Yes, certainly. Thanks, Greg. It's the three books, Unbound Justice, Unshackled and Succession, and they span 37 years of Sydney life in the 19th century, and really sort of focus on John Leary and his ability to fit into the Sydney building scene in 1850, which is the gold rush right through to 1885 and the succession. So the building industry becomes a metaphor for his chosen city. With its mixture of squalor and grandeur, of corruption and high ideals. So if you would like to purchase either one of the novels in the Sandstone trilogy, Amazon's probably your best shot, or in the Kindle edition or Booktopia. Angus and Robinson and Barnes & Noble also have the books available if you'd like to get them. So, it's something that is part of Sydney. But Unbound Justice is the first novel in the Sandstone trilogy, and it's a near magnificent view of 19th century Sydney from the ground up.
Mate, so well said. I tell you, I can't remember how I got your book. It was sent to me, and I'm reading it, and I think it's a great read. The first one, Unbound Justice, and I'll be looking forward to reading the other two. But thanks so much, Michael Beeshall.